Les séminaires du Collège de France.
So we're going to restart with the seminar on models of cognitive functions, and I'm very, very happy today to welcome Professor Elisabeth Pellicano. Elisabeth has a worldwide trajectory. She started in Perth, where she got her PhD, then went to Oxford, then to Bristol and London, and then back to Australia, but on the other side of Australia, in Sydney, in Macquarie University, where she was there for 5 years. And finally, now she's back at UCL. I don't know if it's finally or not, but you are at UCL at the moment, so you cross the channel for us. Thank you very much. And she's a specialist of autism in all of its dimensions, I think, including practical dimensions, how to help children with autism and families with autism. But today she will also speak about the theories of autism and the idea that Bayesian theories, the Bayesian brain, could help explain features of autism. So thank you so much for being here with us, and we are all ears. Thank you.
No, thank you so much, Dennis, for inviting me and for remembering my trajectory, because it's kind of it's a bit complex. It's really lovely to be in Paris, so thank you all for coming along to hear my talk. In the time that I have today, I want to talk about almost a decade of work on a project that I did together with Professor David Burr at the University of Florence, and was funded by the UK's Medical Research Council. And it was looking at autistic people's sensory experiences. I'm going to talk about our attempt to come up with an explanation for those experiences, and also look at the way in which other scientists have responded to our suggestions in the hope of developing a new consensus. Before we get to the detail of the project, though, I think it's important to note why autism research of this kind really matters. I've always been drawn to autism research because the lives of autistic people remain deeply difficult in every country across the globe. Everywhere, there are wonderful autistic children and adults, full of enormous creativity, warmth, insight, and potential, but often living the very hardest of lives. Dying younger, struggling economically and socially, and falling ill far more often than they should. And we still know so little about autism itself, and even less about how to make autistic people's lives more fulfilling, more full of those joyous moments that matter to all of us, and less full of the harder ones. So the key for me has always been to try to do research that can not only open up new intellectual avenues, but also to make a real concrete difference to people's lives. And we've always known that sensory issues or sensory differences might be key to that. So autistic people have sharp sensory differences from non-autistic people. As the Australian autistic author Donna Williams pointed out here, she says the sensory overload caused by bright lights, fluorescent lights, colours and patterns makes the body react as if being attacked or bombarded, resulting in such physical symptoms as headaches, anxiety, panic attacks, and aggression. Now, standardly, these sensory differences have been understood in kind of three ways. As hypersensitivity, so that's a heightened response or an over-response to sensory stimuli. So that might be, you know, sensitivity to dogs barking, babies crying, the sound of alarm going off, the vacuum cleaner, those kind of things. There's also, on the other end of the kind of spectrum, hyposensitivity, so an under-responsiveness to sensory input. So a reduced response, which might include things like, you know, a diminished response to pain or a lack of orienting to novel sights and sounds. And then we have this phenomenon called sensory seeking. And this is a craving of or an interest in sensory experiences that are prolonged or intense. And these might include things like being fascinated by spinning things. So lots of the autistic kids that I worked with, you know, loved washing machines. So they would sit and watch the washing machine go round and round and round. Or fans, just fans spinning around. People can also describe a, you know, really intensely looking at flickering light. So flickering light could be, you know, the light glistening off the water or glistening through leaves on trees. And it can also extend to people. So quite a few adults that I work with, you know, describe craving hugs from other people. So really kind of quite firm touch, firm hugs from other people. So it's important to note that sometimes, just as the ones I've described, those sensory differences can be enjoyable and fulfilling for autistic people. So like the hugs or the intense looking at flickering light. They can offer moments of extreme joy, satisfaction, and relaxation. Many autistic people describe them as soothing or calming. They can, however, also be extremely difficult. They can lead to physical, emotional, and social responses that make everyday life an incredible struggle, as captured in these brilliant cartoons by my London colleague, Ben Connors. Now, although there's been a long history of these symptoms and quite a lot of research interest, particularly in the 1960s and 1970s, until a decade ago or so, we didn't really know much about them. For example, we didn't know how prevalent they were in autistic people. You know, did everyone have, all autistic people have sensory differences? What was people's profile? Did people mostly show hypersensitivity, that oversensitivity, or did they show undersensitivity, or a combination of those things? How were the sensory differences related to other aspects of being autistic, like the social differences, for example? How did these sensory differences manifest over time during development? You know, do they start off particularly pronounced and kind of diminish with age, or is it the opposite? Or do people just get better at managing these issues over time? The focus of my talk today is also, you know, what are the causes of these sensory differences? And there was at the time kind of renewed research interest in this area, in part because in 2013, the diagnostic criteria, the DSM-5, the sensory differences entered the diagnostic criteria for autism. So it never used to be part of the diagnosis for autism, but in 2013, obviously the DSM-5 committee for autism decided that, you know, these were serious enough to enter to be part of the kind of core features of being autistic. And so there was not only renewed research in this area, but renewed kind of practical concern as well. And there was also, you know, that part of the research interest was prompted by the possibility that kind of these sensory differences and some of the non-social features of autism might be attributable to fundamental differences in sensation and perception. And that's what I'm going to turn to now. So it's long been known that perceptual processing is different in autistic people. So very early studies in the 1980s, it reported exceptional performance by autistic children and young people on the embedded figures task, so that's the one on the left, where children are, or people are asked to find a figure, so in this case a triangle, hidden in a larger, more meaningful figure, in this case a pram. When I did my PhD, I worked with autistic preschoolers. There were 3, 4, and 5-year-olds. And this was one of the tasks that I used to look at their perceptual processing, their cognitive processing. And they were amazing on this task. So they were much more accurate and they were much quicker than neurotypical children at finding that hidden figure. Other studies have also shown that, you know, there's exceptional performance on the block design task from the Vexler scale, the IQ scales, intelligence scales, where one needs to kind of you've got three blocks on the bottom and a design, and you have to reconstruct the design from the set of three-dimensional blocks. And still others have shown that autistic people show less susceptibility to illusions like the Kanitsa triangle, so they're less likely to see the illusion. And others too show enhanced performance on standard kind of visual search tasks. So there's been a lot of work showing that autistic people have particular talents relative to non-autistic people in aspects of perception. And there have been several influential attempts to explain these perceptual processing differences. So Uta Frith and Francesca Happe, they coined the theory weak central coherence theory. And that was the first real account that suggested that, you know, to have a proper full account of, you know, what it's like to be autistic, we need to understand not only the difficulties associated with being autistic, but also these strengths and talents. Now, in their theory, they suggested that neurotypical individuals show a drive for coherence. They process stimuli or process information in terms of gestalts and put information in context. In contrast, autistic people, they said, were held to show a weak drive for that coherence, a weak central coherence. So this propensity to focus on details combined with a failure to kind of perceive the overall context or gestalt. Another prominent theory comes from Laurent Motron, who's in Montreal. They suggested that autistic people generally have enhanced perceptual functioning and that, you know, these kind of differences in perception extend beyond kind of local versus global information, but to perceptual processing more broadly. Now, those two accounts, so weak central coherence theory and enhanced perceptual functioning, tended to focus solely on explaining hypersensitivity in autism, so that oversensitivity, enhanced sensitivity to sensory stimuli, which they construed generally as an enhanced ability to perceive sensory stimuli. But it's always been said and been clear that there are a range of sensory differences in autism, like I described. So we've got hypersensitivity, hyposensitivity, sensory-seeking behaviours, all of which need to be explained, not just the hypersensitivity. And moreover, ever since autism was described, you know, in the 1940s and earlier, it's also been clear that it is particularly the unexpected and the unpredictable sensory experience that seems to be the most unsettling for autistic people than the experience themselves. So to give a straightforward example of this, autistic people can sometimes, you know, ring a bell quite happily themselves, even though they react, you know, really strongly against the sound of that same bell when someone else rings it. And especially when the autistic person doesn't know that, you know, that they were going to ring it in advance. And Kanner describes this. Leo Kanner, who gave one of the first descriptions of autism, describes this clearly as well. He says it's not the noise or the motion itself that is dreaded. The disturbance comes from the noise or motion that intrudes itself. The child himself can happily make as great a noise as any that he dreads and moves objects about to his heart's content. What is needed then was a comprehensive account of the nature, the range, and the degree of sensory differences in autistic people. It was this fact that drew Professor Burr and I to deploy the tools of Bayesian decision theory to try to develop a wholly new account of altered sensation and perception in autistic people. In particular, we hypothesized that it was the ways in which perceptual systems deal with uncertainty that might be key to explaining atypicalities in autistic sensation and perception. So we know that information entering our senses is inherently ambiguous. And this uncertainty is due both to, you know, imprecision or noise in the external stimulus and also internal neural noise. And it's long been suggested that in order to resolve that uncertainty, The brain must form perceptual hypotheses, or best guesses, about the structure of the world. And it does this by comparing sensory inputs against an internal working model. This is a very, very crude example, and this might not work. But just to illustrate, take a look at the black and white image on the slide. And if you've never seen it before, then it might take you a little while to detect that in the centre right contains a spotty Dalmatian dog. I don't know, can you see it? Who can see it? Some of you have to look a bit harder. Okay, for those who have seen it, now that you've seen it, you can't really unsee it, can you? It's just really obvious that it's there. And so, you know, you can't help but form that percept immediately. In other words, prior knowledge, in this case that there is a Dalmatian dog in the centre of the image, is essential for disambiguating otherwise ambiguous sensory evidence to achieve a coherent percept. In this case, perception is thus regarded as an inference problem, where knowledge from the past makes a significant contribution to the way that we perceive the world around us. And we turn to Bayesian decision theory because it's a principled method of optimal reasoning under conditions of uncertainty. So it formalises the notion of perception as inference to treat perception as statistical inference. So to resolve uncertainty in the world, we make predictions or hypotheses about the state of the world based on what we observe, so the likelihood of perceiving an event, and on what we expect to observe, so the prior probabilities or bias causing the event, regarding the cause of an event based on previous experiences. And the prior probabilities or bias, regarding the cause of an event, thus matter in shaping our experiences of that event. I'm just going to give you a simple illustration of this. So the image here is ambiguous. I don't know if have you got a pointer? So I'll get the mouse off it so it's even less ambiguous. So that image is a bit ambiguous, okay? It's consistent with multiple objects and viewpoints. And one first impression is like of a half pipe. Or if you're lucky enough to live in Tuscany, where my collaborator lives, then it might look like a Tuscan ruled a roof type, a tile, viewed if you're viewing it from above. But it can also be seen from other viewpoints. Now, the likelihood, which is just here, the likelihood function here, shows the physical interpretations of the image. So it plots curvature against like how the image slant. And the scatter of probabilities around the functions represents the noisiness or imprecision of measuring the image. And then in this panel, we have the observer's prior. So, and that corresponds in this case to a preference for low curvatures and for perceiving objects from above. So when the prior here is multiplied by the likelihood to yield, this one here, the posterior, the range of solutions becomes more constrained. So the best Bayesian guess of the shape to produce the image falls close to shape Y. In this way, priors help to resolve ambiguities in incoming sensory stimuli. And just to give you another example that kind of demonstrates the importance of kind of prior knowledge in interpreting ambiguous sensory information. So this is the Kanitsa triangle. And the Kanitsa triangle, like seeing that, is equally consistent with a continuous white triangle superimposed over three regular black circles, or if you remember Pac-Man in the 1980s, you know, three Pac-Men arranged symmetrically to face one another. So the natural statistics of the world, a white triangle overlaying three regular circles, makes the single triangle more probable. So in this way, illusions are not regarded as kind of perceptual errors or sloppy computations, but as consequences of statistically optimal computations that are functionally beneficial in the real world. And what's this got to do with autistic perception? So we suggested that altered autistic perception results from fundamental atypicalities at the level of the prior, so our internal working models of the world. We were a bit agnostic about how that came about, so whether it was during the construction of the prior, so kind of working up those model, internal working models of the world, or whether it was, you know, combining appropriately kind of incoming sensory information with prior information. Whatever the case, we suggested that it ultimately yielded unusually attenuated priors. And so if we go back to the Tuscan tile example, in autistic people, we're suggesting that the prior, which is here, their prior, is much more attenuated, so more distributed. And when this particular prior, their prior, is multiplied by the likelihood, the image is far less constrained. So it leaves X, Y, and Z kind of almost equally probable. Importantly, we did not suggest that autistic people have no priors. I don't think people would function without any priors, but just that they might be attenuated by degree. And thinking this through, we got really excited. And if we were right, then this should have a substantial effect on the way that autistic people perceive the world around them. It should sometimes result in more accurate or veridical perception, since strong or narrow priors can bias perception towards the prior. Attenuated priors in autistic people should distort incoming sensory signals less. And this might explain, you know, some of those, you know, the enhanced performance that I talked about earlier on the embedded figures task, or reduced susceptibility to illusions, being better at copying impossible figures, those kind of things. So it might account for some of the strengths associated with autistic perception. Attenuated priors should also, however, impede performance in situations where priors actually help to resolve some ambiguity. They could also explain reduced generalization during learning, which is often known as overfitting in computer vision, where a model is fitted to noisy data rather than a general trend. And this might lead someone to, you know, to a mismatch between what one expects to perceive and what the stimulus really is, which align with some phenomenological reports of autistic people. So this comes from an autistic young person who said, "I began to fear all those unknown paths, clothes, shoes, chairs, and strange human voices. Each one challenged me by putting me in front of a new situation for me to face and understand." Here, he's essentially describing the experience of seeing everything afresh rather than mediated by prior knowledge and expectation. I think this is a really extreme example, but it's easy to see from the example how attenuated priors might cause someone to see the world in a different way. What about autistic sensory features themselves? Well, what we suggested was that autistic sensory features aren't due to a fundamental difference in sensory processing per se, but reflected atypicalities in the way that incoming information is interpreted by sensory systems. It might explain enhanced sensations in autistic people, or superqualia, as Richard Gregory referred to it. Attenuated priors could cause a greater reliance on incoming bottom-up sensory signals, which could in turn result in enhancement of sensory stimuli more broadly. So without a kind of, you know, really robust template against which to match observed sensory evidence, the individual might be less able to anticipate the forthcoming sensory environment in order to resolve that perceptual ambiguity. And this might account for why some individuals are hypersensitive in some circumstances and hyposensitive in other circumstances. And fewer internal constraints in the often, you know, reported experience of sensory overload might cause kind of the often reported experience of sensory overload in autistic people. It's not difficult to see, you know, if you've got lots of information coming in and you're not able to filter it as much as other people, you can see how it might be enormously distressing. And what about some of the other non-social features? So autistic people also show, sometimes referred to as kind of repetitive behaviours or stimming behaviours. And they might also show an insistence on sameness, so-called insistence on sameness, where they might be, you know, really wanting things to be the same, essentially, not really wanting change. And priors might aid in the interpretation of predictable sensory events. So less influence by priors should make things less predictable and possibly resulting in kind of like, you know, a need to impose kind of control and order and therefore that insistence on sameness. So all of that led to this paper. It published in 2012, so it's quite a long time ago now. It's 12 years. And since we published it, the argument has, you know, stimulated a really rewarding and important series of debates in the field. According, you know, one recent systematic review said, you know, several groups of researchers quickly responded to recast the discussion that I presented in terms of priors into the predictive coding framework. So according to the predictive coding framework, the brain's activities and connectivity functions as a hierarchical model of processes and hidden causes in the world that give rise to sensory data. And a prediction is the sensory input expected by the brain given its estimates of hidden states. And these predictions may be, you know, more or less precise, so they might be less certain about the predictions. And all changes with the brain plays out according to, you know, this mandate to minimise the sum of the errors by which the predictions deviate from real sensory data, with more precise predictions being given higher weight than less precise predictions. Now, all of the proposals that have ensued, as demonstrated by this by the authors of this recent systematic review, they all kind of vary according to the way that autistic people handle predictive and sensory precision. So the figure that these authors have derived shows the proposals that range from, you know, those that prioritise a kind of predictive processing difficulty, which is here. So that is an autistic difference in the perceptual manifestations of prediction, to those that prioritise, the ones up here, more learning-based difficulties. For example, that Van der Kroes, which is here, this one here, a Belgian group, suggests that kind of the central difficulty in autistic people lies in high inflexible prediction of prediction error, of predict, sorry, inflexible precision of prediction errors, which force the learning of new predictions, even in contexts that are inherently unpredictable. And this view suggests that autism involves not a uniform imbalance in precision, but a failure to contextually modulate precision, resulting in, you know, sometimes perception that might be overly veridical, so accurate, or learning that is instead overfit for the context. I'm going to begin by giving you some evidence and work, our own work, from the more perceptual prediction component, and then I'm going to end on the kind of more learning based studies. But I hope what you can see is that the debate continues. I don't think we have any good answers yet, but it's a good moment to take stock and to ask what we actually have learned from the work done so far, both about those predictive processing difficulties at a more perceptual level, and then also those possible learning-based difficulties. So in terms of priors themselves, in the systematic review that Cannon et al. Conducted, they found, you know, 7 or so papers that showed that, you know, where participants would provide responses reflecting their perceptual experiences and observed, you know, prediction by quantifying its effect as a prior. And all of one of those studies reported that responses from the autistic group were less influenced by priors than responses from the neurotypical group, just as we might predict from our hypothesis. On perceptual adaptation, there have been quite a few studies looking at perceptual adaptation in autistic people with a whole range of stimuli. So adaptation is a fundamental property of sensory systems. It's a form of kind of experience-dependent plasticity in which our current sensory experience is intimately affected by how we viewed the world only moments before. In terms of a predictive coding model, one way to interpret this effect is to say that the participant predicts that the next stimulus will be similar to the previous one and uses that prediction to alter the neural representation of the next stimulus to improve perceptual discrimination performance. And there have been multiple studies, as I said, that have demonstrated reduced perceptual adaptation in autistic children and adults. And I'm going to give you an example. So this is an example of an adaptation task. This is a number adaptation task. And what I want you to do is just stare at the red dot. So not the dots on either side, but just the red dot in the middle for about 30 seconds. So just stare, keep staring. So then I'm going to change the slide and I'm going to ask which patch has more dots. Which do you think? Is it the left or the right? Yeah, the right? Yeah, yeah. Sometimes this doesn't work on a big scale, so don't worry if you didn't see that. But the idea here is that non-autistic people's past experience, seeing lots of dots, the past experience is seeing lots of dots on one particular side of the screen, that dramatically affects their perception of this new information, such that they should tend to see more dots on the right-hand side of the screen, even when they're not really there. There's not more dots on that screen. They're the same. But we tend to see it because we're being essentially biased by our previous experience. So we did this same task with autistic children and young people. And we found that autistic children showed much weaker number adaptation than typical children. So the size of their so-called after effect or the size of their bias was much lower than typical children's, which, you know, we can interpret this as, you know, maybe it's seen as a result of them not being as influenced by the past like neurotypical children were. But if we think about it, they're actually getting the answer right. They were less likely to see more dots where there are, in fact, no more dots. That is, they were seeing the world as it really is, rather than biased by previous experience. So my recent work, we kind of called this out for what it was. So we said, in this study, number perception of autistic children after adaptation was more accurate in that the target patch of dots corresponded better to physical reality than to their expectations. So that's just one example of an adaptation task, but we've also found more vertical perception or reduced adaptation, however we want to look at it, for different types of information, particularly social information like faces and eye gaze, those kind of things as well. So that seems to be a quite consistent effect. Now, in terms of other things we've learned, the role of attention, there is a role of attention. So several studies have implicated attention in autistic prediction. And one of this was also the case in one of our own studies. So we did an adaptation task, just like the one you saw, but this time it was biological motion. We were interested in kind of moving figures. And we found that perceptual adaptation in our autistic participants was kind of, in one sense, it became, once they were attending to the biological motion stimuli, their kind of adaptation was much more neurotypical, if that makes sense. And suggests that kind of there is a top-down influence of attention that may play a role in kind of heightened precision modulation. Now, on predictive learning, so now we've gone kind of we've done perception, and now we're kind of going to the more kind of learning-based processes and experiments. There haven't been many studies looking at that have directly investigated kind of precision modulation, so the capacity to kind of modulate error signaling and learning rate based on kind of patterns of prediction errors. But I'm going to show you an example of one of these. And I'm going to talk in depth about this because it's quite a complicated task. And then I'll talk about a follow-up study that we're just beginning to analyse. So to recap, the decisions we make in a given moment are informed by the expectations that we derive from the outcomes of similar decisions that we've made in the past. And rather than assigning, you know, equal weights to all previous outcomes, neurotypical adults can track the statistics of the environment in order to determine how much weight should be given to new information. Now, when the reward environment is stable, people take account of previous outcomes over many trials to guide their decisions. Yet when the reward environment is volatile, so when it fluctuates or changes over time, it's a bit unpredictable, and so people tend to weight their most recent experience more strongly than distant experience. And the relative weighting given to recent and more distant trials is reflected in a person's learning rate. So in a stable environment where the reward structure is stable, neurotypical adults just demonstrate a low learning rate, as the history across all of those outcomes is more predictive of the current state of the environment than the outcomes of the more recent trials. But in a volatile environment, so it's a changing environment, reward environment, adults demonstrate an increased learning rate, so whereby they take notice of the outcomes of more recent trials and use this to make the prediction about future trials. So our hypothesis was that if autistic people don't use previous experience in the same ways as neurotypical people do, either through weakened priors, like we had suggested, or atypical predictive mechanisms, they may behave differently in a task that involves tracking the statistics of the reward environment. Now, to test this, we administered a child-friendly task to autistic and non-autistic children and non-autistic adults that was based on a well-known task by Tim Behrens. And it was a pirate task that you can see there. And on this task, children were required to choose between two stimuli under two conditions. In the stable condition, the probability of each stimulus being rewarded was fixed. But in the volatile condition, the changing condition, the probability of each stimulus being rewarded changed every 20 trials. And what this allowed us to do is model the learning rates of participants and in turn address our specific predictions. So what did children actually have to do? So they were introduced to images showing two pirate chests, so one was green and one was blue, and each with a flag displaying a reward value between 0 and 100 points. So in this case, the green chest, or the green flag, has 38 points and the blue one has 62 points. It has a combined total of 100. Importantly, only one chest would contain the treasure. That was the goal on each trial. So that's the rewarded stimulus if it contains the treasure. And the other chest would be empty. So that's the non-rewarded stimulus. And critically, children were told that the chest containing the treasure could change throughout the game. So, you know, don't always pick the green one because it might change. And children were required to actively choose either the green or the blue pirate chest on each trial. So if they chose the rewarded stimulus, the chest containing the treasure was revealed, and they were given a number of points or coins indicated on the flag. So if they chose the green one, and it was, you know, the right one, the rewarded stimulus, then they got that amount of points. But if they chose the wrong or the incorrect non-rewarded stimulus, they saw an empty chest, much to their disappointment, and they didn't receive any coins. They were able to see, you see the bit in the middle there, they were able to see the coins accumulating throughout the task, so they kind of kept them motivated to do the task. Now, the critical conditions were that in the first 80 trials, so that's the first half of the task, belonged to the stable condition, okay? So where the ratio of the blue or green response being rewarded was fixed, did not change. But in the last half of the task, or the last 80 trials, that was the volatile condition. So the ratio alternated between 80-20 and 20-80 every 20 trials. So the children weren't, of course, they weren't told that, okay? So they had to pick that up implicitly. So based on Bayesian and predictive coding accounts of autism, we predicted that autistic children would assign more weighting to the outcome of more recent trials than neurotypical children would, and that they wouldn't flexibly update their behaviour in response to the volatility or that changing reward structure. So to test that hypothesis, we estimated the learning rate for each participant by fitting a delta rule model and compared this rate across the stable and the volatile conditions and also across each group, so the autistic children and the non-autistic children and adults. So what did we find? As I hope you can all see here, essentially there are, you know, all groups... this is the stable window here, the learning rate, and this is the volatile part of the volatile condition. So all groups increased their learning rate in the volatile condition compared to the stable condition, but as I hope you can see, there was absolutely no differences at all between autistic children and non-autistic children or adults. So all groups increased their learning rate in the volatile condition to a similar extent, meaning that autistic children used information about the statistics of the reward environment to guide their decisions to a similar extent as neurotypical children and adults. So that was not what we had predicted. So why the null findings? I think there are quite a few explanations. Perhaps differences between autistic and non-autistic children are more apparent maybe during more complex learning tasks where the kind of one-to-one mapping between events is kind of less clear, or when kind of higher levels of the hierarchical, you know, predictive coding model is required. In short, maybe it just wasn't challenging enough for them to reveal kind of like, you know, difficulties. Or maybe such differences might be revealed when autistic children and adults are required to learn about especially uncertain aspects of the environment, like social information. So the task that we presented here wasn't particularly social in nature. You know, it was a pirate game and they had to like work out where the coins were in which pirate's chest. But in the task I'm going to show you now, we added a social component to the task. And this is with my PhD student, Simon Brett. And we've done this task with autistic adults. So the idea was that learning from social information may be one of the most complex things with which the brain is faced, because the uncertainty of kind of modeling another person's generative model of the world. And we've followed another of Tim Berens' studies, which looked at associative learning of social information. Non-autistic adults learn from social information in a Bayesian way. So they flexibly adapt their learning rate for social information between stable and volatile environments when asked to keep track of two prediction errors. And this will become clearer when I talk about it. So Simon and I worked with adults this time, like I said, not children, in part because we needed to conduct this study online during the COVID pandemic. So we weren't allowed, we were in Australia. Australia had very severe lockdown rules, so we weren't doing any in-person research at all. So we were working with autistic adults and non-autistic adults. And we wanted to know whether autistic adults adapted their learning differently to social versus non-social information under varying conditions of uncertainty. So we used the same stimuli. We got adults to do our pirate task, the same one as children. But this time, we added a social cue. So in the main task, adults saw a person come online, just like you would like in a Zoom call, kind of up in the, so here, that's Simon, my PhD student. So he would come online. And they were told that this person, Simon, was to give them advice, a clue on each trial. And the clue would be in the form of a glowing treasure chest, which remained glowing until they made a choice about, you know, which one they thought that contained the treasure. And the treasure chest was open. The person giving this advice, so Simon, however, was actually a Confederate. So he was, you know, in on the game. And he might want to help them win coins in some circumstances, but stop them winning in others. So essentially, the Confederate, Simon, could sometimes be helpful and at other times be unhelpful. So again, this kind of volatility in terms of the social cue or clue. And it was up to the participants to work this out and adjust their behaviour accordingly. Now, crucially, in the first part of the task, and just like in the children's task, the probability of the Confederate's advice was stable and reliable, with 75% of suggestions correct. But during the last half of the task, again, like the task with the children, we changed it up so that the Confederate's advice was volatile. So it switched, it changed between the probability that 80% of the advice was unreliable and correct, and then it switched to 80% reliable and correct every 10 trials. This meant the participants had to keep track of the reward outcome, just like the kids did, so whether it was the blue or the green pirate chest. And they also had to keep track of the helpfulness, how helpful that advice was from Simon, the Confederate. All at once, they had to do both of those things. And to make an optimal decision, participants had to regulate their choice by adjusting the precision of their predictions and incoming information based on the context, sensitive estimation of reward outcome and the Confederate advice. So what did we find? Well, it's a bit complicated. As I hope you can see in this, this is all preliminary, so we're still working this out. But during the stable phase of the reward outcome probability, so this is the blue-green probability of the chest of the pirate chest. Autistic adults had significantly higher learning rates of reward outcome information compared to non-autistic adults, suggesting that they were responding to incoming information to a greater extent than non-autistic adults, which may have meant that autistic adults were overestimating the volatility of the stable reward outcome environment. Whereas during the volatile, that second lot of trials, we found the opposite pattern. So autistic adults didn't increase their learning rate to the same extent as non-autistic participants did, based on the volatility of the environment. So from neurotypical, just as we would predict, neurotypical participants, their learning during the stable, it was a low learning rate, and in the volatile environment, it became a higher learning rate to kind of like they had to deal with that uncertainty. Whereas we didn't see much change across those two conditions in the autistic adults. Now, these findings are in line with our predictions and in contrast to our study with autistic children. Okay, we've found an opposite pattern there. But, and this is where it's complicated, this was during the non-social phase of the task. Okay, this was about the kind of probability, the reward structure of the blue-green pirate chests. But this different way of dealing with volatile information was not found for the learning rates of social information. So we found no significant differences when we were actually modelling the learning rates for the Confederate, like what the Confederate's advice, Simon's advice, which we did not expect, obviously, because we felt that maybe the we would find that the group differences between autistic and non-autistic adults would be greater for social information when there's a greater degree of uncertainty. So as it stands, we don't yet have a powerful explanation for this difference. You know, on the task, kind of wondering, like on the task, adults were asked to take into account both that Confederate advice, Simon's advice, and the reward outcome history when making the decision, so they had to keep both of those things on track. And maybe, I don't know, but maybe when they were required to integrate multiple sources of information, maybe they chose to focus on one source in particular, and in this case, the Confederate's advice. I don't know. We're still analysing these data, as I said, so maybe things will become clearer. I think this is my last line. So while not all of our studies, and of the studies conducted by other researchers as well, have yielded positive results, I think there isn't enough in there to kind of warrant continued research into the nuances of autistic perception and autistic prediction kind of differences, and what these might actually mean for autistic people. I think we have genuinely changed the way that people think about autism and autistic sensory differences, how autistic people, you know, perceive and interpret the world around them. And I think more than that, we've also set an agenda for future research too. I think even despite our pirate game with the Confederate, I think there is room to look at more social priors. While many studies have used kind of socially relevant information like faces or voices, there isn't a lot of research looking at the use of social priors within social contexts. I think there's also enormous scope for looking at the development of priors and predictive processing and how these might develop differently in autistic people over the life course. And these studies, one would hope, would kind of tap into more sophisticated types of prediction within hierarchical predictive processing models. And I think it would also be compelling to examine how the atypical priors or altered predictive processing of the kind we detected map on to the everyday experiences of autistic people. As you've probably seen, like all of the studies conducted in this area, including our own, have so far done so with, you know, controlled experiments in the lab or during COVID in someone's house on a Zoom call. But they, you know, they're very, and that's for good reason, so that we can actually control the experiments. And I think, you know, that more naturalistic experiments will present their own challenges, because doing more naturalistic work is more unpredictable. But I think doing so will be particularly important for understanding the everyday challenges, or lack thereof, of the observed prediction differences for autistic people. Thank you so much.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.